this episode of the Energy Transitions podcast, I speak to Bruce Douglas, CEO of the Global Renewables Alliance, about why he believes the world is approaching a critical tipping point in the shift away from fossil fuels, from electrification and energy security to investment, policy, and the battle against misinformation. Bruce shares why he remains optimistic that the renewable energy transition is not only inevitable, but accelerating. He also explains why it's time to create renewables FOMO to ensure politicians grab a hold of what he refers to as the biggest economic opportunity of our lifetime. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. We're talking about renewable energy in an age where it seems like everyone is talking about geopolitics and energy security. So it's great to get your insights into the topic. Do you believe that recent geopolitical shocks have really changed how governments are considering renewable energy or advancing renewable energy and perhaps the narrative around renewables?
Thanks, Pamela, and thanks for the invite to join the podcast. Well, absolutely is the short answer. I mean, governments are now realizing again, and what is the, you know, the second energy shock, energy crisis in 4 years, that dependence on fossil fuel imports creates insecurity, high and volatile energy prices, and in some cases, restriction on supply. So in Southeast Asia, for example, it's now an existential threat to society there. That realization is continuing because the crisis is continuing. And let me just say, I see it as a fossil fuel crisis, not an energy crisis. So very specific to oil and gas constraints, creating, you know, the turbulence and disturbance in the market. What governments are now doing, and we're tracking this on our website actually with the policy tracker, are taking immediate action to move towards electrified and renewable future. Of course, the narrative is still about, okay, drill, baby, drill, exploit more than gas or even nuclear. But we know that we can show that increased exploitation of oil and gas in many markets won't actually affect the energy price. Certainly not in the short term, and even so in the long term. The actions they're taking is to accelerate electrification, which is a very fast and efficient way to decrease reliance on fossil fuel. Anything that's electrified, be it a car or a heating system, structurally decreases the demand for oil and gas. And that's permanent. Once you've electrified anything, you don't go back. And so governments are putting in a lot of policies to accelerate electrification, but also to accelerate renewables. So that's the generation supply side and the demand side being covered. And on the generation side with renewables, they can see that renewables are the fastest and cheapest way to add new capacity, add new power generation to their systems. And we're seeing that across the world. That's not just in Europe, but I'd say primarily in Asia, in Southeast Asia, where we're seeing Indonesia, Malaysia, South Korea. Around the world, governments are waking up to this and seeing the opportunity. Now, the main reason for this is the economics. So electrotech, on average, is 40% cheaper than it was 4 years ago in the last crisis. So the last crisis, there was already a move towards renewables and electrification, but this time being much cheaper. And now it's significantly cheaper than the fossil fuel alternative. The governments are saying, okay, well, this is not just a security point, this is an economic point, and we can transition fast and provide low-cost, secure, reliable energy to consumers. And those drivers are powerful, you know, and I think, you know, we could probably look back and see this is the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. This is clearly a tipping point, and a lot of governments are now seeing that as such.
Yeah, interesting. And I mean, you refer specifically to Asia as well. I know that they were particularly hard hit, especially after the Strait of Hormuz issues and a lot of the supply constraints that has resulted in. And I think it's interesting for me that governments in that region are really starting to double down, as you say, on electrification and on the renewable agenda. I know that it can depend on governments and administrations, but Are you seeing particular regions that are maybe leading in this regard?
Well, that is linked to their dependence on imported fossil fuel. So what we know is that 75% of the world's population live in countries that are net importers of fossil fuel. So that's significant dependence on someone else for your energy, including Europe and most of Southeast Asia, a lot of African countries. So a lot of those developing countries are dependent on imports, which are now, you know, significantly more expensive and difficult to procure. You know, it does tend to be those countries where they're reliant on fossil fuel, where they're taking action. And again, I mentioned South Korea, but also countries such as Indonesia, which have a large coal-fired power generation capacity, are also switching to renewable electrification because it's cheaper and faster. We are seeing in some markets temporary increase in coal generation, not building new coal-fired power stations, but actually just increasing the use of coal in existing stations just because they need the electricity. But that, in our opinion, would be, you know, a temporary solution whilst they, you know, bring on more renewables and electrify their system.
I want to ask you about your impressions at your Electrics Power Summit, which is where we actually bumped into each other and we're discussing some of the key topics. What were your takeaways from the event? Obviously, there was a lot that was discussed on stage. You were part of a panel as well. And obviously, there's a lot of discussion that happens behind the scenes. So I'm keen to understand from your perspective, what are the main issues on the table?
Yeah. And I mean, first of all, I mean, that summit, the Power Summit organized by Eurelectric is truly fantastic event. I mean, Christian Ruby and his team should be congratulated. It's one of the best events for several reasons. It's very high level participation. They have, you know, they had the president of Finland, they had numerous CEOs and great thought leaders on the stage. But the audience as well, you know, it's really is the leadership of the European power sector. So great opportunity to, you know, take the temperature, as you say, and see what's going on. But the big takeaways were, well, first of all, Finland is incredible, I have to say, being in Helsinki. I think 96% of their electricity is clean. There was significant electrified fleet of cars and heating. I think it's second in the world in terms of heat pumps and catching up fast to Norway in terms of EVs. So very sophisticated society, and almost you could see the future there. You know, they're clean, efficient, stable power price, low power price. So that alone was eye-opening. I haven't been there for a long time. And the second takeaway from the topics was really energy security was top of the list. I mean, Finland being close to Russia, of course, geographically, but also with the crisis in the Middle East. And a lot of the power sector CEOs I spoke to was, yeah, I mean, how do we secure energy for Europe going forward? And the realization again that, you know, dependence on imported gas is not the long-term solution. We have, you know, taken decisions in Europe to cut ourselves off from Russian gas imports, so pipeline gas, but we've pivoted that to predominantly, you know, LNG imports from the US. And so a lot of discussion around that and the opportunity again to develop rapidly renewables. And of course, nuclear was discussed, and there's a lot of nuclear countries, but also nuclear utilities in the room who have nuclear assets, and how those homegrown, clean, domestic power generation sources can secure low and stable power for consumers. Linked to that was competitiveness. So, you know, there's a lot of industry in the room as well. So how about competitive energy? And currently, you know, with the power prices being higher, what is the solution? I mean, I was recommending on taxation of electricity to move taxation on electricity to general taxation. You know, it's a challenge, or is it within countries to deal with taxation, but it doesn't cost any more, and it doesn't cost the public purse anymore. It just shifts the burden across the whole of society away from electricity, which then makes the energy more competitive and gives a lower power price for consumers. I mean, in many European countries, the taxation on electricity is three or four times what it is on gas. So I was just advocating to balance that out. So those were the key topics. There's focuses on grids and storage. There's focuses on corporate sourcing, financing, of course. But yeah, I think those were the main takeaways.
It seems as if industrial competitiveness and electrification is really, it's a hot topic at the moment. And I think the whole idea behind ensuring that industry has access to cheaper electrons is, it's critical. Is renewable energy the answer to that? Or are people saying we should turn to gas because gas is actually how we can provide those cheaper electrons?
I mean, gas is significantly more expensive than renewables in terms of the cost per kilowatt hour. So, I mean, the issue with renewables, as always, is the, you know, it's got a high upfront capital cost, but then zero or close to zero OPEX, you know, because there's no fuel cost. With gas, you've got a high and extremely volatile fuel price. So it can't be trusted. You can't be, you know, have secure energy supplies, or at least at a stable price. But in almost every market in the world, more than 90-95% of the markets in the world now have are developing renewables cheaper than fossil fuel, than gas. And so that is not only the cheapest way to develop new power generation, it's also the fastest. Because, you know, if you want to order a gas turbine now, I mean, good luck getting it in the next 5 or 6 years. Whereas, you know, wind turbines, solar panels are available immediately. You got to obviously develop, build and permit and build the project. But the equipment is available. So, you know, in terms of speed and cost, renewables win. They are the answer always. There's this sort of, the consultants always use this product dilemma. You can have cheap, fast, good, but you can only have two of them. So you can have cheap and fast, but you can't have good. And good in this sense is clean, I suppose, in the energy system. With renewables, you can have all three. You can have cheap, fast, and clean. And in most markets, that's now available. And maybe we touch on later, you know, some of the barriers to that. I mean, I'm making it sound easier than it is. I mean, in many markets, there's still barriers in place to that are delaying and derailing the renewable development.
Talk to me, Bruce, about integrating renewables onto the grid and some of the bottlenecks that Europe is facing right now. What are those bottlenecks and how do we overcome them?
Well, there's two things here. One is, you know, it's not just about more renewables, that's for sure. You know, representing the Global Renewables Alliance, so it's strange me saying that, but, you know, well, clearly we need new renewable development. But in order to utilize the abundant green electrons, we need to move them in time and location. So we need, for that, we need grids and storage. So the optimization and improvement of existing grids, new grid infrastructure, but also the massive build out of storage. So on storage, the costs have come down so dramatically for short duration, but also coming down for long duration storage as well. So short duration batteries, but also long duration like pump storage and other technologies that are coming online now. And with grids, and there's a lot of technologies for optimizing the existing grid. And with new infrastructure, that's new grids, but also new renewables, it's permitting. So it's the social license and the planning process that is slowing down and derailing renewable development. And on that, you know, it's a case of accelerating the permitting process by having more resources in the permitting authorities, changing from a first come, first serve to first ready, first served. So those projects that are actually ready to build, that's grids and renewables, get access to get the permitting first. There's hundreds of gigawatts waiting in queues for grid connection, renewable projects. And there's also hundreds of gigawatts of batteries and grid build out waiting because of permitting. There is actually a European regulation brought in, you know, the emergency measures from the last crisis 4 years ago. And there's only a couple of countries, Germany is one, which have implemented those. It treats renewables as in the national interest, in the public interest. And so when a wind farm comes up for debate, it's usually accepted. And you've seen a huge uptick in wind farm development in Germany because of that. So there's ways to do this, and governments need to implement those regulations as fast as possible in order to accelerate renewable permitting. So it's really on that. I mean, the capital exists, the projects exist, the technology is there, and as I say, it's significantly cheaper. But if you're getting blocked by permitting delays, grid connection delays, then that inevitably shelves the projects.
Bruce, if you could have all the energy ministers around the world in a room and have a few minutes with them, what would your message be to them? I mean, what would you say is the most urgent action, for example, that needs to be taken in order to really move us forward to our tripling renewable energy goals?
Well, I mean, I suppose if it was just 1 minute, like a, you know, elevator pitch, I tried to create some FOMO. I mean, this is a race and it's a huge opportunity. So this is the biggest economic opportunity of our lifetime. And these politicians need to seize that opportunity. And I'm talking about job creation. Globally, we're going to be creating, renewables will be creating 8,000 new jobs a day between now and 2030. You know, that can be in your country. About growth, I mean, GDP growth, investment, inward investment into these technologies. And that's including potentially building manufacturing capacity for export. And then finally, security, insulating your consumers, be it residential consumers or industry, and making them more competitive with cheaper and stable power. That's not even talking about the environmental benefits of renewables and electrification. So those are two things. And what can they do about it? Well, they can introduce national plans. So very clear long-term plans, which include the where, the what, the how, the who, how much questions into those plans. And it should be an integrated plan of where will the load, the new electrification load, including data center loads, be? Where can renewable energy generation be put? And of course, the grid connections and storage required to move those electrons. And that's a, you know, that's a technical task and requires all ministries. You said the energy ministry. I'd say the final piece I'd say to the energy minister, I mean, let's get the finance minister, the infrastructure minister, the, you know, the even the defense minister in the room as well, and talk about, you know, the opportunity of renewable electrification future and how they can work across ministries to deliver this. And the prize is huge, not just economics. I mean, reducing the exposures to fossil fuel price volatility, low cost energy, but also a safer, more secure, cleaner, modern, sophisticated society. As I said, when you go to Finland and see it, or, you know, any electrified society with renewables, you now see what the future looks like. Portugal is a great example. 80% of their power is now coming from renewables. They're electrifying fast. And so you get the sense that this is happening and they should take part of it.
I like that. Creating FOMO. That is that should be a slogan somewhere for how we can really generate interest in renewables. My last question to you, Bruce, is when I met you, you seemed to have such a positive and optimistic outlook. And, you know, obviously there's been a lot of doom and gloom and, you know, people are talking about geopolitical instability that the world is facing and the impact that that is having across industries, but specifically in energy. So to see you and your optimism and your view on not giving up on this was really refreshing. What keeps you so motivated and optimistic? Or did I misread you? Are you perhaps less optimistic, more of a realist? It would be interesting to know your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you, Pamela. No, I am very optimistic, extremely positive, relentlessly optimistic, I'd say. And whenever I go to these events and I speak in an audience, I always ask them, you know, are you more or less optimistic than you were a year ago? I did the same in Helsinki at the Power Summit. And it was almost unanimously more positive, more optimistic than a year ago. So I think despite the geopolitical tensions, the energy crisis and the narrative, I mean, we're clearly losing the narrative battle, a suite of disinformation, but we are winning the economic battle. You know, the real economy is building renewables. Over 90% last year of new power additions was renewable. And so that alone excites me about what's happening, and it's happening fast. I don't think it's happening fast enough. The second thing is that, you know, it's that combination. I'm a bit of an engineer as well as a businessman. And that combination of the engineering side, the business side, and the social and equity side all come together in renewables, and the ability of that technology to deliver, you know, to consumers, provide energy access in Africa, to those who don't have electricity, through to clean and cheap power for industry and the developed world. It's a very significant opportunity. And then finally, I suppose it's, you know, I have children myself, and, you know, the next generation really need to inherit something better than what we're producing at the moment. So I am optimistic. The world is now moving in the right direction. As I said, this is the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. It'll be bumpy. It'll take some time. You know, it won't be an overnight transformation. But over the coming decades, we're going to see a quite a significant change in the global energy system. And that keeps me positive.
Bruce, I know I said that was my last question, but you did mention something, and I have to touch on it now. That is the issue around disinformation, and that renewables is losing that battle. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at the mainstream narrative, it's renewables are expensive, unreliable, you know, they don't work when the wind doesn't blow. EVs are expensive and they burn. And it's relentless industrialized disinformation. So this is a very sophisticated and well-resourced machine that is pushing back against the energy transition. Now, everyone knows, you know, I sort of say, if you know, you know, and if you don't know, you don't know. What I mean by that is, if you actually know about the energy transition, the details of it, you know it's inevitable. You know it's happening, it's happening fast. But if you don't know, and I have a lot of dinner party conversations with friends and who genuinely don't know the details of the energy transition, they assume it's not happening. You know, it's not happening. You know, the answer is oil and gas, or, you know, renewables. Like I say, there's a whole list of bizarre tropes and pushback on what renewables and electrification are. So we need to be much better coordinated, much better resourced, and much more vocal about the benefits. So the job security growth benefits of renewables, how they're delivering affordable, secure energy, and push back against what is, as I say, you know, in mainstream media, a lot of it is anti-net zero, anti-renewables, and pushed by the opposition, you know, our competitors. So, you know, we need to be stronger, more vocal, and better resourced to be able to counter that. Having said that, you know, we're losing in the attention economy, but we're definitely winning in the real economy. So despite that, we're still winning. And so it does, but it does have an effect. It has effect on policies. It has effect on, you know, support for what we're trying to do. So it does delay and distract and often derail what we're trying to do.
Well, I think that just makes it even more important to share messages like yours of eternal optimism. So, Bruce, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure to have you and just to understand more of your perspectives.
Thanks, Pamela. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Energy Transitions podcast, brought to you by Enlit and friends. Visit enlit.world for more episodes. See you next time.